Civil Law Committee will come to order. Representative, do we have minutes? Representative Hillstrom, do you want to approve the Wednesday, March 21st minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom moves approval of the March 21 minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Davids will bring your House file back up for discussion.
It's actually a Senate file, Mr. Chairman.
Senate file.
1934.
The chair will bring Senate file 1934 back up for discussion. Druskowski had moved that motion to be recommended to pass and pass to the General Register. Representative Davids, I think there's an amendment for starters. Let's move the A-12 amendment. Representative Druskowski moves the A-12 amendment for discussion. Representative Davids, are your comments on it?
So yes. Mr. Chair, just for the record, it's A-12-0828.
Very good.
And Mr. Chairman, that's the amendment we talked about that has the Hilty language in it from yesterday, and it also strikes on page 1, deletes line 20 to 23. It deletes that language. And so if we could get the amendment adopted, then I've just got a very few brief comments on the bill.
Okay. On the amendment, to get it in the shape the author would desire, any discussion? Seeing all those in favor of the amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Druskowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move to delete lines 1.3 and 1.4 from the amendment, as they are they duplicate Representative Hilty's oral amendment from yesterday.
Okay. You want to incorporate that in as a friendly amendment?
Representative Simon's on this here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Druskowski incorporates in the oral amendment of deleting lines, say that again?
1.3 and 1.4 from the amendment.
From the A-12 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you. I'd just like Mr. Gehring to verify that is redundant and that the amendment from yesterday is adopted and in place.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, yes, I believe the committee voted on that as a oral amendment yesterday, so it's already incorporated in the text of the bill.
Thank you.
So to the A-12 amendment as orally amended, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Davids, to the bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I thank the committee for the time they spent on this yesterday. I think I think people understand the issue, and I'd appreciate a yes vote and get it to the House floor and to the General Register. And if there's other concerns folks have, we'd certainly listen to every one of those concerns.
Representative Lesh, and then Representative Hillstrom. And we have one, Mr. Carlson, did you want to make comment on this as amended?
Barely willing.
Okay. Okay. You're the only one I have on our list to speak. So, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it may be just that I'm slow, and I may have gotten around to just today the way Representative Hortman was understanding this yesterday, that the existing language, unamended language, the language in the statute before the bill was clear. And now maybe this is, I might be having difficulty with this. And this is based upon the question I asked yesterday. It's my understanding of the gentleman from the Township Mutual Insurance Companies spoke to me after tax committee. They were good enough to clarify. But maybe you can, the gentleman can clarify the question as was stated, that I think I understood you to say that this entire section was written just with Township Mutual Fire Insurance Companies in mind, and that there are no other entities in the state of Minnesota that write combination policies. Is that right?
Under 67A, that's
Mr. Marsh, that's why don't you identify yourself for the record?
Marcus Marsh with the Fire Mutual Insurance Association. To Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, that is my understanding that no one else writes combination policies under 67A.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair,
we'll have our legal counsel come up to just to help make sure that everything gets answered.
Mr. Wolken?
Yep, he's...
Is that who you want to have come up?
Right.
Paul Wolken, yes, Representative, that's an accurate statement. We did some review last night, and Township Mutuals are the only creature, if you will, that are issuing combination policies under 67A, and the revisions were drafted certainly with the intent that it would have application only to the Township Mutual industry.
Okay, so then, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesch,
this then begs a question that I asked towards the end of committee yesterday, which is that language in the sentence starting on 1.17 through to 1.19, what would be, if this statute was originally written regarding specifically Township Mutual Fire Insurance Companies and it applies to no one else, why was that language, if you thought this was originally intended to not cover homeowner policies in that way, what was the purpose and intent of that original language that homeowners' portions of that policy would have the benefit of the provisions of 67A?
65A.
Is it 65A? I'm screwing those up.
65.
So regular property and casualty
right.
Policies. Yeah, 65A. Why would that language even be in there in the first place?
Well, first of all, let me say, Representative, although I was not involved in that process and so forth, I am aware that at the time that 67A-191 was passed, there were discussions between the Department of Commerce and the Township Mutual Industry, and at that time, the Township Mutual Industry had approached the Department of Commerce and had expressed an interest to, on occasion, write what would probably be considered a homeowner's policy. In other words, a policy where there wasn't farm coverages, farm buildings, livestock, equipment, etc. And the discussions at that time between the association and the Department of Commerce were such that if the Township Mutuals wanted to do that and write what would be considered a homeowner's policy under that at that time existing law, then the condition, of course, would be that they would have to play by the rules that non-township mutuals like American Family and State Farm would write their homeowners. And that was the agreement, and that was the embodiment of the agreement is the language we see in Subdivision 2, so that if a township mutual were to write a policy that would not be considered a combination farm policy and write a true homeowner's policy, they would then have to abide by things such as the two-year policy period of limitation contained in 65A, value policy law, the cancellation procedures that statewides would comply with. And that was, and the result is the language that we have, that we see in Subdivision 2. So I would underscore that if a township mutual wants to issue what would consider to be a homeowner's policy under Subdivision 2, they are required to follow all of the rules that any other insurer would in issuing such a policy. And those are the rules under 65A, and that's what Subdivision 2 attempts to state.
So then, Mr. Wilkin, is your testimony that the language prior to the these amended changes was crystal clear to you and probably should be to everyone else, and for some reason the Court of Appeals just didn't have their Wheaties that morning, got it wrong?
Well, I guess that's one way of characterizing it, Representative. I go back to my comment. I don't want to rehash what I said yesterday, but again, it was our position, and it remains our position, that 67A14 Subdivision 1 clearly defines what qualified property means. That's the statute under 67A that's longstanding that defines and states what qualified property includes. And qualified property under that other statute specifically includes dwellings and household goods. And by including this revision in subdivision 1, it's our intent to simply clarify and, if you will, acknowledge that there is a distinction between a farm combination policy and a homeowner's policy, and in the case of a subdivision 1 policy, that includes qualified property on dwellings.
Okay. No further questions.
No further. Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, my question was going to be for Representative Davids. You typically say there's peace in the valley on your bills when you've reached a conclusion. Is there peace in the valley, Representative Davids?
We're not quite there yet. I mean, it's not quite feeling the love yet, but we're getting there. We're working on it. We're not quite there yet.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, is it your intention to have peace in the valley before you bring this up on the floor?
I would like to get there, and I'll work very hard to get there, but I can't. I'm not going to write checks my body can't cash, and I and that'd be a big check if you think about it. But I'll do my best. I will meet with all interested parties to see, you know, if we can't get this worked out.
Mr. Carlson, maybe we should have you come.
And Mr. Chairman, this has been fascinating the last 2 days before civil law. I have a long, and I say that very positively, of course. I have another commitment. I'm going to turn this bill over to Representative Raskowski, if that's okay with the
that's
chair.
That's not funny, Representative Davids.
No, it's been just all sorts of fun. if I could turn over to Representative Raskowski to carry me home here, but you've got my word that I will continue to work on this, but I can't guarantee the result.
More fun than a barrel of lawyers.
That's it. Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you for passing this to the floor.
Just running out of the tough.
Yes.
Mr. Carlson, identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice. And I've had a chance to do a little homework and research on this issue. One of our members, Attorney White, who was here and is seated next to me, had brought this issue to our attention. That wasn't particularly on our radar screen. I don't like being against my second favorite insurance agent in the legislature, Urban Grunhagen being my first.
We can say that now that he's
I would have reversed order had Chairman David still been here. But we do have a concern with the change, and I appreciate deleting the confusing language, but I really think if you look at this language, you're setting up an ambiguity in the law, because you do not change or repeal anything in Subdivision 2. And so as we read it, and as the Court of Appeals found very clearly on its face, that portions of a combination policy providing homeowners insurance, including those issued by Township Mutual Insurance Company, are subject to the provisions of 65A. That's what the Court of Appeals found. This was a homeowner's policy. It should have been, and the Court of Appeals found, that it was protected by 65A, which means a two-year statute of limitations, the value policy, where they paid a premium on the policy of somewhere over $500,000. If you have a total loss, you're supposed to get that what you paid for. And, as we understand it, that's how it should operate and has operated since 1994, which is when the legislature adopted Subdivision 2 at the request of Township Mutuals so that they could sell homeowner insurance while they were also insuring farm property. As I read the change on line 1.11, you don't define dwelling as a home, number one, but you're saying that now they can insure dwellings and be immune from the provisions of 65A, but you don't touch Subdivision 2, which says that it has to be covered by 65A. So I think you're setting up a conflict in the law, and but you're making a very clear policy choice. Do you want farm homes to be covered by the standard homeowner insurance policy or not? And that is the policy question for the legislature to decide. And we would argue that a farm home is no different than my home in town, And why wouldn't we protect them as they are currently by the provisions of 65A? So the language, and we're happy to continue to work with, you know, Representative Davids and the proponents, but the language right now is not any more clear than what than what you're trying to get at with what you deleted in Subdivision 2. And I appreciate Representative Hilty making the change to make certain it doesn't apply to any pending litigation, which we believe it would without his amendment, because the case right now as it stands is submitted back to the court on remand for further proceeding. And what would the law be without that amendment? So we appreciate you fixing that. But this, I don't think, gets us there either. So I don't know, Mr. Chairman, how much more testimony you want on this. We do have, we brought in an insurance expert from New Ulm to testify. If you want to know about combination policies and how 65A applies, we've got a witness here, Richard Green, that's happy to go through all that with you and why the legislature wanted these policies to be subject to 65A. I don't know if we need to go there or not, but we're prepared to, because we think all homeowners should be protected by that, and this at best creates an ambiguity and at worst removes that protection for them. That's our, that would be our read of it, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Let's see if there's questions from the committee, and Representative Grunhagen and then Representative Lush.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as I'm Mr. Carlson's favorite insurance agent, I'll try to live up to that reputation. Now, the you know, I work with Township Mutuals. I have an independent insurance agency. And one of the things about this is by having the ability to write it under 67A, it gives certain advantages to the Township Mutuals with farm property. And farm property is very difficult to get insured in today and in the past market. There's not a lot of companies that want to write farm properties. In fact, I've got about 8 or 9 companies that write through my agency, and I had one of my agents just look to see if we could find an alternative company for a particular farm, and some of those companies used to write it, none of them do anymore. So the Township Mutual, being, you know, Minnesota based, has been given a unique situation here under 67A, because it helps them to insure the farm property, specifically not necessarily newer homes like in the case of the claim. And the claim is completely distinctly separate from this agreement here. I don't want to get into the minutia of the claim. But without that provision, a lot of 67A, they're not going to be able to write a lot of those older homes on the farm. The result is they're going to have very great difficulty getting insurance in the market, and a lot of those farm places are going to have to go to the Minnesota Fair Plan. Now, there's people here from the industry that could confirm that, but that particular provision, so I guess I see your concern about the confusion here, but if you could work from the standpoint of critiquing the bill rather than just trying to force the townships to write under 65A, I think customers as a whole, especially farm-based property, will not lose the benefit of what's been given to them for, if I remember from last committee meeting, of over 90 years of being able to write under 67A.
And Mr. Chairman and
Mr. Carlson,
Representative Grunhagen, absolutely we're not expressing any problems about the good work that Township Mutual Insurance Companies do. We're not expressing any concern about that. But you have to, just to dissect the bill, you have to assume that the legislature meant something in 1994 when they adopted Subdivision 2, which authorized Township Mutuals to sell home insurance. But if you're going to sell that insurance, you're going to be subject to 65A, so they're protected like every other homeowner. And so as you dissect the bill, I would say they've never had the ability to not comply with that. And now we're creating an ambiguity as to whether or not they would be able to, because you don't define dwelling and you don't on in subdivision one, and you leave subdivision two in place. So what is it going to be in the policy? You know, we don't know what the disclosure is to the farm homeowner. You know, that it may say 1 year in their policy, but then it also says it has to be consistent with law, and so you don't really know what it is. As you dissect the bill, you have to, you can't reconcile subdivision one and leaving the language in subdivision two. That's our point, and okay. How we can reconcile that, we're happy to work on, but you can't reconcile it right now.
Mr. Chair, could I?
Representative Grunhagen, and then Representative Gruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen, I think you would relate to this too, having grown up on a farm and worked with a lot of farms and their record keeping members. Looking at this from the point of view of the farm family, it is very, very, very common for farmers to, for insurance purposes, for tax purposes, and for a variety of purposes, to lump all of the buildings on their homestead together. You know, the house in 1 acre, we hear it over and over again, but for tax purposes, the house is rolled in right within the agricultural building. So this is consistent with them. I'd encourage members to support the bill.
And Mr. Chairman and members, just so we're clear, that is not what happened in this instance. They had a separate stated policy, a separate stated premium for the homeowner insurance. It was not an aggregate policy to cover the entire farm. They had a separate stated policy limit, which, by the way, the policy limit was set and adjusted by the insurance company. The homeowner didn't say, "I want $550,000 of insurance." They came out, appraised the property, said, "That's what you're gonna, that's what we're gonna insure it for. That's what you're gonna pay your premium on."
Yep.
And that is, I think, you know, we need to, at least in this instance, and probably all of them, because they have to sell that. They have to sell that homeowner insurance to another through another company. So we have to assume that they're writing for the risk based on 65A. I don't know how we can reconcile that.
Mr. Chair, the... yeah, and I, again, I'm not disputing the facts of the case, okay? That has its own merits or and will be decided. But I'm just saying that what the Township Mutuals are trying to retain here is the ability to be able to write their home in with the rest of the farm buildings under 67A, and if... And if we don't retain that for them, they may not be able to insure the house at all. And especially in terms of older farmhouses, it's going to be very difficult for them to get insurance in the private market that's out there right now. Mr. Chair, I'd just like to hear a quick response to Mr. Carlson's comments by the Township Mutual attorney.
Mr. Wilkin?
And Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Mr. White wants to illuminate the committee on this issue as well, but he's here, and I think he has some comments he'd like to make.
Okay. So. Let's hear from Mr. Wilkin, and then Mr. White. Everybody, keep in mind, brief is better. 1 to 2 minutes, Mr. Wilkin, if you could just give us a response. Could somebody just step back and take the front row? And then we'll play up musical chairs for a little bit.
Two very brief comments.
Okay.
Mr.
Wilkin, identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Paul Wilkin. Two very brief comments. First of all, I think that there were some statements made there with respect to this particular case, which I don't mean to dwell on, which misstate the facts of the case. I was involved in this case, and the policy provided for a premium for multiple coverages of farm buildings, a dwelling, farm property, et cetera, stated under one premium. So I think there's been some misstatement here in terms of what the facts of the case were. But more importantly, gentlemen, in terms of the argument that's been made that we're introducing some type of ambiguity into the statute, I have to again repeat the language of 67A14. I think it might be helpful to some of the members of the committee to review that, because that says, and this is current existing law that's been in place for a long time, 67A14 says that qualified property means dwellings.
household goods, et cetera, et cetera. That's what the current Minnesota law says. Qualified property means dwellings. And under the revision to subdivision 1, we are simply restating that in subdivision 1, that the portion of the combination policy issued by Township Mutual Company includes dwellings. So we're not introducing any new concept, any new provision, and I would take the argument and make the argument that what we've heard here in opposition to this bill is the position that Township Mutuals should be bound by valued policy law whenever a household is involved in a loss, and that has not been the law in Minnesota. So in effect, it's the opposition that would introduce a new concept under Minnesota law.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we'll actually have a question for Mr. Wilkin then based on that. So, Mr. Wilkin, if this law were to pass with the new language, would there be any instances of farmers' homes in the state of Minnesota that would retain the benefit of the language, the existing language that's been passed since 1994 that says all portions of the combination policy providing homeowners insurance, including those issued by a township mutual insurance company, are subject to the provisions of Chapter 65A. Would there be any homes? And what would, I see you're nodding yes. What homes would those be?
Well, take for example the farmer who sells his property or deeds his property to his son or his daughter and builds a structure on another portion of the farmstead. That's a typical situation that a township mutual would insure. Under that particular situation, when that person goes to a township mutual and has a policy issued, that would be a policy on that person's homestead or house. And I would submit that under that particular scenario, which is totally unlike the scenario that we have in this case here, where we've got a house, farm buildings, outbuildings, farm machinery, livestock, etc., insured under one policy, the argument, I think, would be made that that's a homeowner's policy, and that person, that policyholder, gets the protection of 65A. So that in the instance of loss to that particular kind of a dwelling, the Township Mutual would have to abide by the same rules that the American Families and so forth have to, including a two-year period of cancellation, valued policy law, and cancellation procedures, etc.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesch,
then what's your estimation of the number of farmers out there who think that their home under Township Mutual Fire Insurance policies, who think that their home under those policies is insured just like my home is on Dale Street in St. Paul or Representative Simon's home in St. Louis Park? What percentage of those farmers think that their policies are insured that way and are going to be subject to a rude awakening if this bill passes?
Mr. Wilkin.
Representative, I don't mean to be flippant, but I don't know how anyone would be able to ever answer a question like that intelligently. I mean, an argument could be made that if you asked any homeowner whether they're insured by a township mutual or a statewide, what they think their policy says, I suspect you'd probably have a pretty significant portion of policyholders that don't understand what their insurance policy says or means. But I will say, in response to your question, Representative, and a comment that was made by Mr. White yesterday, there was nothing in this policy that had hidden language that was not clear and conformed to statutory requirements of clear and plain English in the policy. So every policyholder has an opportunity to read their policy and understand the terms of that document. And there was no evidence in this case, not one iota of evidence ever raised in this case, that somehow the Township Mutual inserted some language, or that there was confusing language, or that the insured did not have an opportunity to read his policy, go through it with the agent. Nothing like that was involved in this case. And furthermore, I think it's significant, Representative, that when this case started out, and a demand was made after the loss to the house, the insured didn't take the position, with the benefit of legal counsel, did not make a demand for the entire amount of the stated value of the house in the policy. a demand was made for less than the stated value in the policy, and yet the opposition today is arguing and suggesting that every house in every township mutual insurance policy should adhere to the value policy law. That wasn't even the demand that was made in this particular case when it started out, and it led to the appraisal process.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
That sounds like a mistake that maybe your lawyers might have made if, in fact, they didn't see this coming, or some lawyers made it somewhere. And I'll take exception to your first statement that people don't know what's in their policies. I can tell you, I know Representative Holberg knows her policy, wrote and can recite it just like the Gettysburg Address at the drop of a hat. So,
show you, Representative Lesh.
Absolutely not, Mr. Chair. I don't even know if I'm insured or not. I like to live my life on the edge.
What I meant to say, Representative, is not that people don't know, that I don't know how many people would understand completely what is in their insurance policy. Okay. I can't gauge that.
I think he's playing a little with him. Well,
Mr. Hogan, just Mr. Chair, I'm trying, and you did answer my question to a certain extent that there may be some stuff still out there that applies under that existing language that was passed in 1994 of 1.17 through 1.19. But are you telling me that the entire time since 1994 there's not a single township mutual fire insurance company lawyer who contemplated that the Court of Appeals would ever interpret the law the way that they have under the current court case?
Mr. Wilkin?
If I understand the question correctly, Representative, the question is, did anyone representing a township mutual as a lawyer ever contemplate the kind of decision that the Court of Appeals issued? Is that the question, Representative?
Correct. Yes, Mr. Chair, yes.
My answer to that would be, of course, any attorney might contemplate the kind of decision that came down in the Court of Appeals, only in the sense that since 1994 we have a Subdivision 1 and a Subdivision 2, which clearly was intended to recognize that a township mutual may in one instance issue a farm combination policy or a homeowner's policy. And that's one of the reasons I guess we're here, Representative, is to offer some clarification in Subdivision 1 so that that ambiguity would be lessened.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Wilkin, can you tell me why wouldn't you, rather than add the language at the bottom in lines 1.20 to 1.23, why wouldn't you just seek to delete everything after the period in line 1.17 of that language saying all portions of the combination policy providing homeowners insurance are subject to the provisions of 65A? Why wouldn't you just delete that?
Mr. Walker.
It seems to me that would remove an infinite loop of reasoning that is causing so much confusion.
Well, again, 1.17 to 0.19 is the existing statutory language which, when this particular statute was enacted, was put in place, I'm assuming, because I wasn't personally involved in that, but the logical assumption would be that the state of Minnesota, the Department of Commerce, and so forth, was concerned that if township mutuals were going to go ahead and write a homeowner's policy, they had to be subject to the provisions of 65A. And my understanding is that in large part because of the concerns expressed by the Department of Commerce, that language that you suggest could or should be deleted was inserted to make the department comfortable that if township mutuals were to step out of their usual and customary bounds of writing a combination farm policy and issued a true homeowner's policy, that they would have to be then complicit with 65A.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I just, by way of comment, I think just based on the length of this discussion, I do believe that the additional language, and I understand what Representative Davids is trying to do, but I think that he's trying to walk a line by providing additional protections for township mutual fire insurance companies
But in walking that line, it's removing protections from consumers, namely consumers who are farmers. And I have concerns about that. And maybe I'm not getting it, but I think at this point I get it enough, or at least as much as the Court of Appeals. And so I'm going to ask for a roll call on this, Mr. Chair, because I think it's something that impacts consumers. So that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Mr. Wolken, on this topic, and then Representative Holberg has a question. Is it your understanding the pricing of a township mutual policy, a farm policy, wouldn't be with value pricing or value policy in it? And so there's a difference in premiums that would be collected under one of these policies versus one that's subject to 65A?
Mr. Chair, I'm not the best person to answer that question.
Is there
an industry person would be better suited to answer that. So
who would?
Mr. Ron would be able to address that better than I could, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Representative Holberg, you have a question for Mr. Wolken.
My question
Mr.
is
Mr. Ron can come
for
up
for the advocates of this. First of all, Mr. Chair, and I can say this because Chair Hoppe's out of the room, but I think the Civil Law Committee is now going into its third hour of discussion on insurance policy, which maybe would have been much better held in the Commerce Committee, number one. Number two, I'm curious if there was ever any opportunity or attempt to discuss Representative Hortman's concerns that were expressed yesterday before committee, and why or why not we have any language to address the nature of her concern about the circular issue that Representative Lush has brought up.
Who's best to answer this?
Mr. Chair, Marcus Marsh of the Farm Mutual. We tried, there seemed to be people that had suggestion here, suggestion there, and that's why we just went ahead and took that new language back out, and felt that, well, let's just take that out because of what's still there, I think, fixes the problem that we have. And so I don't think the discussion needs to continue. Quite frankly, Mr. Chair and Representative, this is a very simple issue. What's been in statute has been there for years, working with the Department of Commerce. We all know what the issue is. The fact of the matter is, Mr. Ron testified, last 5 years we've had about 41,000 claims with hardly a problem. There's been a problem a couple of times when there's been certain public adjusters involved. This case went through the court process. We're just trying to get back to what has been the situation for the last 75, 80 years. There's nothing sinister. You know, our companies are mutuals. The policy holders own the company. They have annual meetings. Policy holders are on the board of directors. There's nothing sinister here. These are small local companies, and they treat their people so incredibly good. You would be amazed if you came to one of these annual meetings. These are the nicest people in the world. I've worked a lot of different jobs, but I can tell you, these people wouldn't cheat a mouse out of a morsel. They are the nicest people, and any indication or any comments made by the opponents that somehow this is a problem and we're cheating people, a mutual, for goodness sakes, we try to keep the rates low so that the people pay as little as possible. Nobody can beat our farm rates. Very few people have, and the farms have an opportunity, because the big companies, you know what they do? They say you got to be so many minutes or so many miles from the fire department. Nobody will write them except us. The department has understood that. We have the department to proves everything we do. We have narrow investments. Everything we do, the department has to approve. And we have done just a marvelous job. So I just want to make it clear that somehow I think there's some tones here that something we're doing is inappropriate. And geez whiz, this is kind of a sneaky way of doing things. We're just trying to keep the policy like it's been. We think there was an error made. And our policy holders, I think they know what's in the policy. And they're appreciative of our low rates and the good service they get. And so, Mr. Chair, I think we can just go ahead and have a vote. I think people know what the issue is. Either you're for it or you're against it. And I know there's a question for Mr. Ron, so I'll let him respond.
Representative Hillstrom, you have a question?
I have a question for him, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So, I'm sorry, I missed your name.
Mr. Marsh.
Okay. So you said that you've been working with the Commerce Department through this whole process. So for this bill change, have they been working with the Commerce Department, and has the Commerce Department signed off on this proposed change?
We met with the commissioner before the bill was introduced. They're well aware of it. I don't want to talk, I don't know if someone's here from the Commerce Department. I don't want to speak for them. The comments made is they understood the issue. They know it's a concern to us. They were going to tell us if they had any opposition when we left the meeting and Mr. Ron was there. They were basically neutral on the issue. And we try to keep in touch, and we haven't heard there's any objection at all from the department. But they haven't been, you know, necessarily speaking out for it, but they're aware of it. And they did express they know it's a concern to us, and did not object at all for us going forward with the legislation.
Representative Mahoney, and then members, we do have two more bills we need to get to. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to build on what Representative Holberg said, you know, we've spent 3 hours here. I spent years sitting on the Commerce Committee. I understand that's typically where insurance issues are dealt with. In the Commerce Committee, I am under the impression they spent a couple of hours on it. We've spent three. This is 5 hours. And the best advice that I've heard from anyone is Representative Atkins, who said, why don't we wait until after the Supreme Court rules on this particular issue, come back next year, and actually deal with this issue. Right now, as I said yesterday, and I'm not afraid to step on the judge's toes every once in a while, I've done it while I've been up here, but I think this is one of those issues that is better served by waiting to hear what the Supreme Court or the District Court or whoever at the end of the day rules on it, come back and actually, if we have to put in new legislation that deals with this, that's fine, because Mr. Marsh, I've known you for a good number of years, and you, what you said about the co-ops and the mutuals is correct. They typically work to go to great lengths to make sure that their members and their customers are well taken care of. I have no doubts about that. But again, as I said yesterday, and I think I voted against, the only one who voted against the amendment, for the simple fact that this is probably one of those that we really need to let the court system run its course, come back, and write new legislation that addresses this. So I'm hoping that when this vote comes up, you vote no, or the author of the bill holds it over, and this whole thing goes away until after the Supreme Court is done. I didn't have a question. It's my comment. I'll be quiet again.
Mr. White, 2 minutes, and then we are going to proceed to a vote.
I understand the requirement of being brief, and I'll do my best. I just want to respond quickly to some of the comments that were made by Mr. Wolkin. Number one, the question was raised by Representative Lesch, is what did the legislature have in mind in 1994, if not what it seems to be the clear language of the statute that they passed? Mr. Wolkin talked that it seems to be some idea to denigrate the Court of Appeals. Mr. Wilkins spoke at some length about meetings that took place in 1994 that he didn't attend and nobody in this room attended. I will tell you that the Court of Appeals asked him that exact same question. What did they mean if they didn't mean the plain meaning of the language that they adopted? And at the Court of Appeals, Mr. Wilkins said he thought that it was to apply to houses that weren't on a farm. And the Court of Appeals specifically rejected that as being unsupported. Now, we're not bound by the rules of evidence here, but they are bound by the rules of evidence, and they rejected that as being unsupported. Second issue I'd like to address is what has kind of been the boogeyman in this whole thing, that we're taking the position that any farm that has a house on it is subject in total to 65A. I can tell you that in our case, I didn't take that position at all, because the statute doesn't take that position. The statute says a policy known as a homeowner's insurance and defined by Section 65A.27. That section talks about a package of coverages that are typically sold to homeowners. We have never taken the position that if there's a house, it's subject to 65A. We don't have that. We don't have that situation. We have that package of coverages that are typically sold to a homeowner.
And that's second, Mr. White. Representative Holbrook.
If I might, and I'm kind of cranky and I apologize, but as I look at this bill would not even be in this committee if not for the lawsuit. This is a commerce issue. It's an insurance issue. We amended this to say that no way would this apply to anything until moving forward, for claims moving forward. I think as a civil law committee, we've kind of covered what would be the civil law issue related to this policy change because there is a pending lawsuit. I really think, I don't know who made the motion to move it, but I would suggest that they amend the motion to move without recommendation. We are not going to solve insurance policy here in our third hour of discussion on this issue. And quite frankly, we have less than an hour left of committee with two more bills to do. And as far as I can tell, these people really don't like each other, and they were involved in court battles with each other, and it's replaying out here on the testimony stand, and I am not a judge.
Point well taken, Representative Holbrook. When Mr. White's done, we are going to be taking a vote. He's got about 45 seconds left.
Last issue.
Skowski can take into consideration amending his motion. And Mr. White, please wrap it up.
Mr. Chairman, the last issue I'd like to address is the question of whether the insurance policy is confusing or sneaky. I don't think I ever used the word sneaky, but I will tell you it is confusing. And I will give you a general description of the format. For example, we talk about the one-year statute of limitations. It will say that there's a one-year statute of limitations. Then somewhere later in the policy, it will say, if anything in this policy conflicts with state statute, the state statute prevails. So a person reading this, and assuming this is a policyholder and not a court of appeals judge or a lawyer, is not going to likely read past the 1 year before assuming that there's a 1 year statute of limitations. And that format, I think, is confusing to most people and was confusing in this issue. It's just an example. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. White. Representative Viskowski, you heard Representative Holbrook. What are your wishes? I'd like to renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House or Senate File 1934 be recommended to pass and place on the General Register.
Great. The clerk having a roll call being called, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Westrom?
Yes.
Representative Druskowski?
Yes.
Representative Lesch?
No.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Hilty? Representative Holbrook?
Pass.
Representative Hoppe? Representative Hortman? Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative Mazzaro?
Yes.
Representative Pepin?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Runbeck?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Wardlow?
Yes.
By a vote of 8 yes and 6 no, the motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And to Representative Viskowski. Thank you to all who came. Next, Representative Holbrook. Representative Holbrook moves SF 1212 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, it's Senate File 1212, and you should have had passed out engrossed copy, I believe, at the top. Let's see. It says House Engrossment of a Senate File. That's the correct copy. This is a pretty simple concept. You'll see on page 2 of the bill that We define patient, and we give access to, and this is in the case of for medical records, current law gives access to surviving spouse, parents of a deceased patient, or the person a patient appoints as a representative. And we're running into situations in which people have passed and their surviving adult children can't get access to medical records. They may suspect some type of abuse or neglect in a nursing home, or in one instance, a couple years later, they get diagnosed with a particular disease and want the opportunity to review their parents' medical records to see if there are any indicators of that as well. And so this would allow surviving adult children access to patients' records.
Representative Holberg, what issue, is there some issues out there that have brought this forward, and do the children get it even if there's a surviving spouse or a parent?
Mr. Chair, the way the bill is written, they would get it in addition to a surviving spouse. So there could be a surviving spouse that would be still alive, that, and under the bill as written, a surviving adult child could also receive access to that.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holberg, the only thing I would, was kind of surprised that you didn't put the ability for a patient or, you know, a parent that might have passed to have put in their medical record or whatever, that they don't want anyone other than the surviving spouse or whomever to get it. But that, it, there's a ways between here and the floor, you know, that you can get it too. And if you so, with your depth of knowledge on data privacy, I think you might take a look at that and see if it works.
All right, thank you.
Representative Scott, and then Representative Holberg, you have two witnesses?
There may be witnesses. Okay. Nobody's spoken opposition to this that I'm aware of. There might be people here to testify. Okay.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holberg, I had a bill that we had just an informational hearing on a few weeks ago that talks about vulnerable adults. And one of the problems, or one of the reasons for the bill that I brought forward, is because after the vulnerable adult passes away, the only person that has access to many of their personal records is an executor or the personal
representative
of the estate. And so would these two things jive? Would this make it so I don't need my bill? I mean, if the adult child is not the executor, there's nothing in law preventing them, then if this bill passes, from getting those records. Am
exactly.
I understanding that right?
Mr. Chair, I believe that would be true.
Okay. There's two people that wanted, Mr. Garrity, what group do you represent?
Myself.
Yourself.
I am an attorney.
Okay.
I ran into this problem. I had a first-hand
Come up to the table. We are under time, and so I don't sense a lot of trouble. We don't need a 10-minute explanation. Give us a 60-second explanation.
No. Okay. I ran into problem.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Michael C. Garrity. I'm an attorney, and I had a first-hand experience with this, with the thing this bill addresses. Mother came home from a rehab facility, had a nasty laceration in her arm. They did not treat it in the facility. They did not report it to me, and I wanted to investigate it after her death. She died a month later, and the facilities will not release the records unless you're the personal representative, you're the executor, or the other requirements, parent of a deceased person or the surviving spouse. And HIPAA, I did some research on HIPAA, and HIPAA has a policy, and they're now doing some rulemaking on this right now, saying that they want to make it real clear that the family members, surviving family members, should have that right. In fact, back in 2002, they had a advisory opinion from HIPAA that says the surviving children of the parent should have the right to review the records. So So what happens is the medical facilities are using the current law in Minnesota as a way to stonewall on releasing the records. How else do you, are you going to know if there was some maltreatment or some negligence? And that's what I ran into, that they would not release the records. Now, you have to bring a probate in order to get access to the records. That's what they're basically telling you. If you don't meet those other two requirements, you have to bring a probate. A lot of the middle class do not have probate estates. They do not do a probate, or they may have a revocable trust. And so then they're cut off. So you're saying the current law says they have to bring a probate in order to get access to those records, and that should not be the case. There are all kinds of people, I'm sure, that would like to know what happened to their deceased loved one, and they're not able to under the current law. There's a very strong policy reason to have this law change. I found about this indirectly. I was trying to go through the healthcare directive to access, but there's even problems with that. There's some questions about whether that ends the powers under the healthcare directive end at death or not. And so that most of the providers are saying it does end at death, the powers, although I don't believe it does. But so there's a necessity for this change in law, a very strong policy reason. I'm sure there's all kinds of family members out there that are unable to find out what happened to their loved ones if there was mistreatment. Very strong policy reasons for this.
Thank you, Mr. Garrity. Ms. Newman also wants to briefly testify. Ms. Newman? Also, can you keep it very short?
Hi, my name is Holly Newman. Thank you for letting me speak. My father passed away in 2006, and I brought this, and we've tried everything legally to get his medical records. The hereditary background in our family is very unusual, and we need them for medical reasons for ourselves. I mean, this bill changing this could save my life or my grandchild's life, my great, you know, anybody else's in my family's life. Since then, my daughter was sick. She was in a motorcycle accident, got a bad infection, which is, she was in the same hospital my dad died in. So her infection was similar to the infection that her grandfather had, and the hospital truly could not help us. They could not look at his records and see if there's anything in there that could help her, to help treat her. So, you know, there was no legal course for us to get the records. And a lot of times you don't have time to go through probate, you know, because if it happens on the weekend, they need the records right now. They can't, you know, get the records quickly. And in families of divorce, when the parents are divorced, the children from the first marriage or whatever, we have no legal way to get the records whatsoever.
Thank you, Ms. Newman.
Thank you.
Representative Holberg, I'm going to just express a concern I have. It seems to me this makes sense, but with stepchildren and a widow or a widower getting remarried, it seems to me there's some complexities there. And also, if there's a spouse still living, I guess I've got questions in my own mind. Those are things that I would like to just maybe have explored or discuss a little further. I think for today, I don't sense a lot of opposition. Maybe I'm the only one with some reservations or questions on some of those issues, but I would like to see us work on that if it comes to the floor. But I think as a general rule, it seems like a good policy direction. Any other questions or comments, members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, there's a couple issues that have been brought to my attention kind of on the side here, but I think we need to take a second look at this, and I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in Representative Holberg renews her motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Representative Pepin. Representative Pepin moves House File 2341 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Pepin. Tell us about your bill, and Ms. Bowers wants to testify as well.
Ms. Harris.
Oh, Ms. Harris.
A new change from last session.
I see. Things change all the time, don't they?
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be somewhat brief. I think the There's a lot of information in the bill. But basically, the bill requires that a physician administering RU 486 or any other drug or chemical for the purpose of abortion, that the doctor be physically present in the same room with the woman seeking the abortion. So it doesn't outlaw chemical abortions, or it doesn't prevent a woman from having a chemical abortion. It just says if they're going to have an abortion, the doctor has to be physically present in the room. And that's basically the gist of it, and then it provides the victim with some appropriate recourse as well through civil and criminal penalties.
Very good.
And I do have Ms. Harris here. For
Ms. Harris, any further testimony?
Mr. Chair, I would be available for questions, but okay. I don't have any testimony.
Very good. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to testify for or against this? Linnea House?
Representative Westrom?
Yes, welcome to our committee. Can you stick to the point, and we're a little constrained for time, but welcome. Identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you. I'll be quick and to the point. Chairman Westrom and members of the committee, it's my honor to be here today. My name is Linnea House. I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota, a 50,000-member-strong nonprofit organization committed to protecting women's reproductive rights in Minnesota. I'm here to testify against House File 2341, and I respectfully urge your vote against this bill. RU 486, or medical abortion, is the first and only FDA-approved medication providing women with safe and effective procedural options for early pregnancy termination. Mifepristone, or RU 486, has been tested extensively and used safely and effectively worldwide since 1981 and in the United States since 2000. By 2005, about one-fifth of women in the U.S. who received abortion care used mifepristone. And in fact, the rate of reported adverse effects for mifepristone is very low, approximately 0.28%, and mifepristone is as safe or as safer than many commonly used other medications, such as Viagra and Tylenol. In addition, telemedicine is the delivery of a healthcare service using telecommunications technology, video conferencing, transmission of still images, remote monitoring of vital signs, and continuing medical education are all considered part of telemedicine. Telemedicine is becoming more common practice. Many fields of medicine, including cardiology, pediatrics, dentistry, psychiatry, are using it to deliver health services. This type of care also holds promise for reproductive health services. The system of telemedicine is especially important for Americans who live in remote or rural areas and do not have access to a nearby doctor who need a specialist located across the country. 95% of Minnesota counties have no abortion provider. It is extremely difficult for women to travel to a reproductive health clinic where they can access abortion services directly from a provider. And most importantly, according to a 2011 study on the use of telemedicine for medical abortion, there is no major difference in complications between in-person and telemedicine care, and telemedicine patients were in fact more likely to report satisfaction with their care. Finally, claims that using telemedicine to dispense mifepristone is dangerous to women because it lacks appropriate care and oversight from medical professionals is false. Just as with any other doctor's visit, a woman undergoes tests, counseling, and an examination with a registered nurse who is present with the patient during the telemedicine interview and who is there to provide resources for follow-up questions and to schedule a follow-up examination. The bill before you today does nothing to protect women's health. Instead, it adds additional barriers for women, as well as setting the precedent in the state to ban procedures using 21st century technology. Again, I ask you to vote no on House File 2341, as it is unnecessary and targets one type of health care provider. Politically motivated health regulations are medically unnecessary and inappropriate, putting women at more risk. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. House, the question for you, but it may be a question. I don't know if there's a doctor who's going to testify at all. If we don't have one, I'll ask you. Is there a point in the pregnancy where this particular drug cannot be prescribed? Medically, I guess.
So, Representative Lesh, it is my understanding that medical abortions are used in early pregnancy, so generally within the first 7 weeks. When it is the safest time to perform abortions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, my question then is, if I'm a woman
who is struggling with a decision but cannot get access because I live in an area that I don't have access to a clinic in the first 7 weeks. Does this law then potentially impact a greater percentage of late-term abortions?
Ms. House?
Representative Lesh, my understanding is that the further that you delay access to health care, it can increase. I don't know if there's going to be a direct correlation, but I think that the earlier that women can get access to the health care that they want, I think the better.
Well, Mr. Chair, the reason I ask is obviously this committee is divided on this issue. It's one of the big three at the legislature where no one's ever going to change anyone's mind on it. But there are some nuanced areas. And I had a group of pro-life students in my office last week that had major concerns with later term abortions. And I'm not talking just third trimester, I'm talking second trimester. And they said anything you can do to reduce those late term abortions is important to us. And so enacting a law that would reduce early abortions and somehow, if it has the chance of increasing later-term abortions, I obviously have a concern with that. But even these students in my office would have a concern with it. So that's why I asked the question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Peffin, any comment on that?
Well, thank you, Representative Lesh. I didn't say this in my opening comments because I thought there'd be some questions. But I mean, one of the concerns I have with the drug, and the FDA has approved it for 7 weeks. I've heard it may be used later than 7 weeks. But there have been 14 deaths, 612 hospitalizations, and 58 ectopic pregnancies. So I believe it's important to have a physician there so he can physically examine the woman, because if the doctor's not examining the woman, then there's going to be some serious problems. And even when the doctor's there, there's still 5 to 8% of women who will need a surgical abortion anyway, even if they take this drug. And so I just want to make it as safe as possible for a woman. And, of course, doctors do have to be present for surgical abortions. So I just think it's a safety measure. I want to make sure that a doctor's there and has a chance to physically examine her to make sure there aren't any undetected problems.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh,
and I appreciate that. I just, as you were talking, I was thinking about an article I read last week about the number of deaths related to infections that people get from being in the hospital being not related to the original reason they went there. And unless germs can crawl through the telephone line, I think do anything we can to keep people out of the hospital first and would make sense. But that's it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I was noticing that the motion was to send this to the General Register, and there is a new criminal penalty on page 2, line 2.9 to 2.12, and I was noticing that it did not go to the Public Safety Committee, and this, in fact, creates a new felony. So, Mr. Chair, I think the appropriate motion would be to send this to the Public Safety Committee, because I don't think we create new crimes in Minnesota without at least looking into the potential fiscal nature of those crimes, and I believe the proper place to do that is public safety. So, Mr. Chair, if you're not interested in amending that, I would actually make a formal motion, and I would ask for a roll call on whether or not this should go to the Public Safety Committee, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom, Representative Peppin.
I would speak against that motion for a couple of reasons. This is, first of all, the chair of the committee did not ask for it, does not want to see the bill. And second of all, I believe, maybe Representative Holberg can answer this, I believe that this is a course that has been taken in a very similar legislation in the past.
Representative Hellstrom, if we can finish discussion, we'll come back to you before we renew the motion. Is that fair?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to ask a whole lot more questions about the criminal penalties and the impact it's going to have on public safety if that motion doesn't pass. So
okay.
As long as you're not giving me latitude then to ask as many public safety questions as I want, if it's not going there, I would let you defer it. I'm fine, Mr. Chair.
We've gotten the same communication from the committee, Public Safety Committee, Representative Cornish, that they don't need to see this bill, so I'm not inclined to to modify the motion, but we can sort of take the vote if you want, and if that changes your what you need to do in committee, why don't we do that?
Okay, that'd be great, Mr. Chair.
At the present time, Representative Hillstrom moves to amend the motion, and I guess we'll amend it, and then we'll read. On the motion to amend the bill's referral from the General Register to the Public Safety, any discussion on that specific motion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
I asked for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom asked for a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Westrom?
No.
Representative Druskowski? Representative Lesh?
Aye.
Representative Grunhagen? Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Hilty?
Aye.
Representative Holberg?
No.
Representative Hoppe?
No.
Representative Hortman? Representative Mahoney?
Aye.
Representative Mazerall?
No.
Representative Pepin?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Runbeck?
No.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Wardlow?
No.
I'm here.
Representative Grunhagen?
No.
Don't tell me I voted in agreement with the Democrat.
That's okay. 6 yes, 9 no's. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Pepin, then I want to specifically ask you about these criminal penalties because they're certainly not going to be addressed in public safety. So, can you explain to me? It says any person who knowingly or recklessly performs or attempts to perform. So, attempts to perform knowingly and recklessly, or just attempts to perform in general?
Representative Pepin.
The definition, Representative Hillstrom, is on line 1.16 to 1.19. Attempt to perform or induce an abortion means an act or an omission of a statutorily required act that under the circumstances as the actor believes them to be constitutes a substantial step in a course of conduct planned to culminate in the performance or induction of an abortion in the state in violation of this act.
Okay, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So have you asked for a fiscal note from the Department of Corrections?
There is no fiscal note, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you asked for a fiscal note and you included the Department of Corrections in your fiscal note request.
Representative Pepin. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, you don't necessarily ask which departments. When you make a fiscal note report, they all look at it. So you don't, like, ask a particular, whether it be courts or corrections that might have, like in this case, an impact. But we just had a discussion. I can't remember if there's an actual fiscal note, but we have looked into this, and there was not going to be a cost. So it was de minimis or whatever as far as the number of felonies that they thought would be that could be prosecuted under this. So I can't remember if there's an official fiscal note. I can remember a discussion around the bill. And so
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then a follow-up for Representative Holberg. So when we do public safety fiscal notes, we do two types, two numbers we really look at. We look at what the cost is going to be, right, to the courts and to the Department of Corrections. And then we look at the long-term bed impact, right, because you might not have an impact today on the Department of Corrections and the number of beds used, but you might in the long term. And so do you next portion that was looked at as well? Because, again, on all other felonies that we look at in this state, those are the two pieces that they've always required me to get on any new felony I've introduced. And let me tell you, I've introduced a few.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I'm not certain of the bed impact issue, but generally I think it would be a little unusual that you would have substantial bed impact in that fiscal note.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Billstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, because of bed impacts, typically you get them in the out years, and so you might have no fiscal impact in this biennium or even the next, but you may in the long run add up and ultimately then have fiscal costs, which is why they make us count those bed impacts. And so then the question that I would have also about the fiscal note is sometimes you do have to specifically ask the courts to take a look at it. If there does end up having a fiscal impact, a fiscal note that was done, it would be nice to know whether or not the court was asked to give input on whether or not it would cost them any money. Those are the ones that we always look at. And again, this is the proper place for these questions to be asked is in the Public Safety Committee. I mean, that is the proper place for this to be. And, you know, I disagree with the policy, but we have a responsibility to protect the process. Whether I'm going to win the vote or lose the vote, we have a responsibility to send bills to the proper committees. And frankly, whether the chair would like to hear the bill on a subject, maybe he's for it or against it, it really is the responsibility of the chair to have every new crime go through public safety. So,
Representative Hellstrom, you didn't prevail on your motion. There will be other venues or opportunities you will have to make this discussion. We don't deal with the fiscal cost. We have information that there wouldn't be a fiscal cost that would require it to go through there. The normal process, which you want to protect, is that the chairs and the committee staff do make discretionary calls on what they want to hear. It can be referred from the floor back to the Public Safety Committee, which can be a discussion you have with Representative Cornish if you want to follow up on that. Those are all options that will still be available to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I will be looking at those options, but I think that before these questions get to the floor, somebody should at least know that people have questions about them, because otherwise you're going to say, this went through the whole committee process and nobody raised this as an issue. Why are you raising this as an issue now, Representative Billstrom, on the floor of the House? Those are the proper questions for the committee process.
Duly noted.
And if I might.
Representative Holbrook.
Representative Hillstrom, my colleagues on my side of the aisle could confirm this, but I'm not letting anything go up to the floor if it even smells that there's a fiscal note or impact. And I got people nodding my head over here. So, I mean, that goes for all bills, and the discussion was made. And so I just want you to know that if something costs money, you know, it's been coming to Ways and Means, and I have a nasty note from Chair David's, $235,000, really, with question mark, you know, so.
So, Mr. Chair, just one final question, then I won't ask another one. So, in the event I ask the agencies in the department if there's a fiscal cost, you would not oppose the motion for me to move it back to Ways and Means? Because the motion is to put it on the floor.
Representative Hillstrom, you can ask a lot of people.
I'm asking specifically Representative Holberg if she would oppose my motion to send it back to her committee if I find out that it has a fiscal note. That's the direct question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, if there is a bill or a fiscal note that shows an impact, a fiscal impact, I would be more than happy to take the bill to my committee.
Thank you.
Now, Representative Hillstrom, is that with you cajoling and influencing the outcome, or just asking the question straight up?
Mr.
That
Chair.
Was rhetorical.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I've said it in this committee before, and I don't quite understand why people decide that they can denigrate our departments or our other elected officials here. We can cajole, we can jump up and down. Our departments do not try to bring forth fiscal notes that we influence. Those are accountants, and if you try to influence an accountant, you may as well talk to a wall.
Representative Mahoney, you've served not quite as long as I, but quite a long time. There's a well-respected member that I had a lot of respect for, and I will quote him, Representative Solberg. There have been a lot of good bills killed with fiscal notes and a lot of good bad bills passed with fiscal notes. You can interpret that. I think you interpret it the same way I do. So, but point well taken. We don't deal with fiscal notes in this issue. So back to the bill and the policy at hand. Is there any questions? Representative Simon, you were on the list.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is either for Ms. Harris or for the author, Representative Pepin. I notice here on line 2.33 there is an exclusion for the pregnant woman. So the pregnant woman is not subject to a lawsuit under this bill. But as I look to the criminal portion, which is at line 2.9, and if I look over to the definition on line 1.16 of what attempt to perform or induce an abortion, the way I read it, let me know if it's not your intent, but the way I read it is that a woman is subject to the criminal penalty because the definition is an act or an omission of a statutorily required act that, under the circumstances as the actor believes them to be, constitutes a substantial step in the course of conduct to culminate in the performance or induction of an abortion. The language there is loose enough, at least as I read it, to include the woman. So it is your intention that a pregnant woman could be criminally prosecuted under this?
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, this language is in this bill to make very clear that simply taking the RU486 drug is not the chemical act, but not being physically present when you're the physician administering it is what we're talking about. This just ensures that the woman cannot be criminalized for actually taking or possessing the drug. That's not what this legislation is about.
Representative Simon.
Well, okay. I mean, I certainly take your explanation in good faith, but that's not your intention. I'm just saying, as I read the language, it says here that, I mean, somebody who takes, an actor who takes a substantial course of conduct for which there's a plan to culminate in the performance. I mean, it's there's enough passive voice formulation here so that I think a reasonable person might conclude that the woman is criminally liable here. I understand and take you at your word that that's not your intention.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Pepin.
I'm sorry, Representative Simon, could you just direct me again to where the two sections, again, I want to
sure.
make sure I'm
yeah.
following.
No, one is just the 2.9 is the criminal penalty.
2.9.
But I understand that 1.16 is the definition of the phrase attempt to perform or induce.
Representative Wardlow, did you have a question to this?
Maybe I can provide a little bit of clarity. As I read it, subdivision 6 on line 2.33 does make very clear that no pregnant woman who takes the drug or possesses the drug is going to be prosecuted or subject to any civil penalty. But the real thing that makes this clear that there's no criminal penalty for the woman is if subdivision 3, 2.9 states and 2.10 that any person knowingly or recklessly performs or attempts to perform an abortion in violation of this section shall be guilty of a felony. And to be in violation of this section, you can look back at subdivision 2, which talks about the physician's physical presence being required. And the physician's physical presence being required, if you read through that section, makes very clear that it is the physician perhaps a physician's assistant, the people administering the drug that are subject to potential criminal penalty, not the woman.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott?
Yeah, thank you.
On
the very end of 2.10, starting with the word no and through 2.12, no penalty may be assessed against the female upon whom the abortion is performed or attempted to be performed. So right there removes the woman from any.
Ms. Harris?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to also clarify for the record that this is not a drug that you get a prescription for and then go to the pharmacy. This is a drug that can only be obtained from a physician. So the purpose here is that the physician, when administering it, be physically present and in the same room and not doing it remotely.
Ms. Harris, if it needs to be administered and you get it from the physician, how could they do it remotely? Somebody would illegally have to be holding the drug then?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Harris.
J- just to clarify, currently at the Rochester Planned Parenthood Clinic, these drugs are being administered remotely using a closed-circuit video conferencing system where the physician is located in the Twin Cities and the woman sits in front of the computer in Rochester, and when a button is pushed on the physician's end, a locked drawer pops open where the drugs are for her to take. So the physician is not currently physically in the same room, and this is happening remotely currently. This legislation would just say that if this is going to continue to happen and these chemical abortions are going to be administered, that the physician be on site and in the physical presence of the woman.
Very well. Representative Simon. Follow up.
Thank you. I thank you for Representative Scott for pointing out that second sentence. I think that's right. It says no penalty may be assessed against the female. So I hadn't seen that at first. So what I do have, as long as I have the microphone, I have a couple of questions for Ms. House, if she's...
Ms. House?
Thank you, Ms. House. Could you, and maybe you said it earlier and I just didn't hear, do you have any statistics or evidence that you can share with us about the safety of this procedure in terms of deaths? I know Representative Pepin mentioned some deaths. I don't know whether that was nationwide or in the state or internationally. Or,
Ms. House?
Do you have any? Do you contest that? And if you do, what other statistics or evidence do you have?
Representative Simon, I didn't bring my documentation in front of me, but I think that the numbers that Representative Pepin was referring to were nationwide numbers, and I think that we're talking 14 deaths out of, I think we heard in the hearing earlier this week, out of over a million procedures being done, and I think I testified that it was the complication rate is 0.28%, which is an incredibly low rate of complications, and it's actually safer to take RU-46, there's fewer complications than Viagra or Tylenol.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
I also just wanted to ask Ms. House about...
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make an amendment.
As long as it's not substantial, Representative Mahoney.
Viagra has to be administered by a doctor in his or her physical presence.
I think that would ruin the intent. Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's just one other question.
Yeah, it just depends on what the... Never mind.
Took you guys a while to figure that one
just
out.
One other question and then a quick comment. The question has to do just on the potential burdens here. And what, in your opinion, if any, would the additional burdens be if this were to be enacted into law? And on whom?
Ms. House.
Representative Simon. So as I stated before, 95% of... Minnesota counties do not have an abortion provider. I think the largest burden would be on women who are living in greater Minnesota who have to travel the furthest to receive health care. By having one facility down in Rochester allows women to not travel as far as necessary to receive the procedure. Minnesota has a whole host of laws regulating abortion. A woman receiving RU-46 still has to have her 24-hour waiting period. She still has to have her court-mandated or legislatively mandated script from the doctor. There's a whole host of things, and this just allows women to not have to travel either to the Twin Cities or Duluth to receive their procedure.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I have a follow-up, but I'll wait.
Representative Simon.
I'll cede just for a moment to Representative Wardlow.
On Wardlow to that point?
Representative Simon, Mr. Chair, I don't believe there is a right, constitutional or otherwise, in Minnesota or in the United States for convenient abortions. So there is no burden coming from this bill on any cognizable constitutional right.
Representative Wardlow, I believe there is a right to privacy and the right to make your own medical decisions, though I believe...
Representative Simon, follow up, and then Representative Lesh, Representative Scott, and then we will proceed to a vote.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say that, thank you. I think it's important to get that on the record, at least your opinion as to that. As Representative Lesh said, this is one of those issues where I think we all knew the minute we saw this bill, we were all going to vote on it, and I certainly respect people who think differently from me on this issue. I think people come down on different sides but have principled opinions. So I think we know what the outcome is. I just have one last on a slightly lighter note, Mr. Chair, just on a on the note, since this is one of probably one of our last hearings, maybe our last hearing, I can't resist just slightly tweaking Representative Masrell and Representative Wardlow on the fact that on line 2.29 there is an attorney fee provision in this bill. So if there were a lawsuit, they'd be entitled to recover their attorney's fee. I'm not saying, I'm just saying.
I would have been disappointed.
I can't help myself.
Representative Simon, we're going to try to carve out time for Mr. Carlson to come before us before this
Please.
Bill.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Representative Simon for the final shot.
It wasn't a knockout. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Representative Davis started in this hearing, he said he couldn't feel the love. I think he'd say something different if he were here now. But my question is for Representative Pepin. Are there any other drugs for which we expressly criminalize the telemedicine option? Any other drugs in Minnesota that you can think of?
Representative Pepin, or Ms. Harris, Ms. Howells.
Well, Representative Blush, I don't know your answer directly, but I know that it's used in other states. This legislation has been used in other states.
Okay. Well, I'll take that as an I don't know, Mr. Chair. Second question, Mr. Chair, is for Representative Pepin. If I called a doctor in Wisconsin, or if a patient called a doctor in Wisconsin, and they prescribed this by phone, would we be issuing extradition orders for that, or how would we? And if so, that's the question related to the criminal side of it. But then also, is there some obligation for Minnesota to tell all the physicians in the United States that this is the law in Minnesota? How would that work? Let's start with the first question. How would the long arm of Minnesota law reach out and grab Wisconsin doctor?
Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, an answer to both of your questions would be that this is not something a doctor can prescribe over the phone and the woman then can go pick up the drug. She has to get it directly from the physician. In other words, currently, prior to this new innovative way to administer this, she had to get it directly from the physician in the physical presence. Now, currently, using the method that I discussed earlier, they are, you know, physicians are the only ones administering this drug, technically, but they're not even in the physical presence or in the same location as the woman. So this isn't something where a physician in Wisconsin can put in a phone call to a pharmacy and the woman could go pick it up or anything like that.
Okay, well, you change my scenario then to your description, then, if we still have that. As I understand it, maybe
can a doctor from Wisconsin administer it is your question?
Correct.
Ms. Harris.
And can then come here or however you want to.
And then do we have jurisdiction to stop them? That's your second question, right, Representative?
Correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, we have actually a law in Minnesota that says only a physician licensed to practice medicine pursuant to Chapter 147, which I believe is licensed by the Board of Medical Practice here in Minnesota, are the only physicians, you know, that would be able to perform an abortion in Minnesota.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holden.
It actually begs the question that we're probably behind technology in our policy. Is the act of practicing medicine in this situation where the doctor's located or where the patient's located?
Representative Lesch, any
follow-up? Hence my question about how we're going to deal with this. If this occurs more and more, Mr. Chair, that is something we have to encounter. Now, it's not a question of federal law, but it's crossing jurisdictional lines. So that's just one more reason why I think this needs to have consideration in the Public Safety Committee, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Or Ms. Harris.
Representative Lesch, just to clarify, we have other telemedicine-related laws in Minnesota that require that physicians who are going to be performing telemedicine register with the state, so they would be notified as well through that process about this requirement should this become law.
So which... Mr. Chair, if I could ask, and I'm sorry, will you tell me your name again?
It's Ms. Jordan Harris.
That's right, Ms. Harris. So which for that, Tomas, you said you didn't know if there are other drugs. So are there other fields of medicine that are regulated by the telemedicine statutes? Or I guess I don't know anything about these. So what can I not do by telemedicine in other parts of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Harris.
Representative Lesh. I don't have all of the specifics of every last requirement for telemedicine, but I do know that even if there were other ways that were to be created to administer this drug without the physician being physically present is, quite frankly, not the issue. The issue here is we want to make sure that women seeking an abortion have a patient-doctor relationship with the physician and that the physician be in the same room and in the physical presence of the woman when administering these drugs, which would be the same standard for a surgical abortion and currently is in Minnesota.
Okay, I don't think my other questions are going to go anywhere, Mr. Chair. So, okay, no more. I still think this should go to the criminal law committee because we're getting into the weeds a lot. And what's
Representative Lesh, any follow up? Representative Scott's going to be the last one, and then we're going to a vote.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's my understanding that the Senate deleted the criminal penalties, and given that this is not going to the Public Safety Committee, I would make a motion to delete line 2.9 to line 2.12, deleting the criminal penalties.
Representative Hillstrom has moved to delete. Restate those lines.
Line 2.9 to line 2.12. Let me place that. And then also on line 3.1, deleting after the word or, deleting criminal proceeding. And a roll call is requested, Mr. Chair.
Roll call is requested. Does everybody have the oral amendment? Any questions? The clerk will take the roll. Oh, Representative Holbert. Representative Pepin?
I'd prefer to leave the bill as it is for now, but I'll defer to the will of the committee.
Sounds like you got conference committee coming up.
We do. We will.
Any brief questions? Clerk will take the roll on the oral amendment by Representative Hillstrom.
Representative Westrum?
No.
Representative Droszkowski?
No.
Representative Lesh?
Aye.
Representative Grunhagen?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Hilty?
Aye.
Representative Holberg?
No.
Representative Hoppe? Representative Hortman? Representative Mahoney?
Aye.
Representative Mazurell?
No.
Representative Pepin?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Runbeck?
No.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Wardlow?
No.
Six ayes. Six yes, nine no. The motion does not prevail. Representative Scott?
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. And this is to either one of the testifiers. I guess I'm confused by the notion that people that live far away from a clinic that performs abortions, I'm confused because if, in order for this drug to be prescribed, doesn't the patient first have to see the doctor in person to get the prescription? I mean, if you want a prescription for anything, don't you have to go see your doctor first to make sure that you're healthy enough to have that prescription? And they look at your records and make sure nothing's going to be, you know, conflicting.
Is this to Ms. House or Ms.?
Either one of the testifiers.
Ms. House?
Oh, no, this is, well.
Ms. Harris? Stephan, whoever wants the answer.
Chair Westrum, I think you need to have your committee administrator help out. But
I think he helps fine, Representative.
I'm just joking.
If you want to, whoever wants to answer it, you guys figure out who's got the answer.
I think that the standards may be different. I'm not a doctor, but I think the standards are different for whether or not they can prescribe in person for other things. But for this, the FDA did recommend, or no, they did rule that the drug was have to be given by a prescription. So they do have to get a prescription. The physician has to give them the prescription. I don't know what the case is.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, there's not a prescription in the sense where if you get a prescription for the antibiotic, you take it to the pharmacy and you get it. This can only be administered by a physician according to FDA protocol. However,
okay. Representative Scott.
Typically, yes, a woman should be getting a physical examination and evaluation prior to having an abortion. However, if you walk into a satellite clinic where there currently isn't a physician anyway, and you're going to be getting this drug administered to you remotely with the physician potentially hundreds of miles away, no, that woman would not be getting the physical examination and evaluation from that physician.
Okay. I guess I was under the assumption that before you were able to get any prescription that a physician had to see you and write it out.
I don't know.
But I guess maybe that's not the law. I don't know. Thank you.
Representative Pepin renews her motion to pass House file. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You have a motion for this. We are done with the discussion.
I have some comments on this bill. I don't really say a whole lot on abortions, but frankly, I'm a little tired of this. So far during this session, after hearing nothing but to the start of this session about jobs, 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 and more jobs, I have seen us work on Castle Doctrine, on right to work for less, marriage amendments, now abortion. Any of these things come to the floor, they're going to be hours, hours and hours, and does not include anything but a job for a hotel operator, so some poor woman is going to have to go spend a couple extra days in Duluth or the Twin Cities, or some gas station attendant who's going to have to pump the gas, or take the money, I guess, because we don't pump gas anymore other than we do it, take the money. So, Representative Pepin, how does this help jobs? How does this help the economy? All of a sudden now we're just putting more hindrances in the face of some poor woman trying to control her own reproductive rights.
All those in favor of the Pepin motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, that is the last bill we have on the agenda. I don't think we'll have another meeting, but if there is, we will let you know.
We have another meeting when we do this kind of stuff.
We'll let you know, Representative Mahoney, if we do. I do want to thank everybody for their participation. Thank the page and our staff for the help they do behind the scenes to make the committee run smooth. Sarah Novinsky, John Reynolds, Grace, I don't know your last name, and the DFL research and the Republican research. Thank you for your contributions to our committee. Members, thank you for a good year, and this will probably be my last of a law meeting as a chair. So for some of you, we will rejoice. Others, you can keep your comments to yourself. So, thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.